Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Okay, folks, welcome to another edition of Life on Planet Porky, or Planet Porky to abbreviate it. Thank you very much for tuning in. I've had a fantastic response, by the way, to the podcast we've put out so far, myself and my wonderful production and technical team here. And I love the responses I'm getting from you all. Please keep them coming in, okay? Now, I'd like to start the Planet Porky podcast with a statement of intent about things that are concerning me I've seen this week. And I want to start off, believe it or not, with my observations from a public house, OK? Now, as you know, I've been quite a regular user, bladderation in moderation, of course, of public houses for quite a long time. But let me tell you this. Some things about pubs these days are getting on my nerves greatly. And, for instance, I was in rather a nice pub in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, this week. And I like to go at quieter times rather than louder times, mid-afternoon or something like that. I like to sit at the back, mind my own business, read a couple of my journals without a problem. And then somebody comes in, right? And this pub, actually, the door was shielded from the bar, if you see what I mean. You came in and you had to turn sort of left for the bar. So anybody who came in and turned right could sort of hide away, okay? So this guy comes in and he sits on a table two away from me, a high table with a high stool. And he puts his laptop down and he goes off and he gets a cup of coffee. Can you believe that? A cup of coffee in a pub. People want coffee. Please go to Costa or Nesto, whatever it's called. You know, whatever these coffee bars are called, because the high streets are full of them. You don't need to go into a pub to have a cup of coffee. You really don't, okay? And it annoys me when people do. It annoys me for two reasons. Excuse me. Firstly, I think public houses should be there for people to drink beer and wines and spirits and all that kind of stuff, okay? But also, I do believe that people queuing up at the bar to buy coffee are a bloody nuisance, an absolute bloody nuisance. Because when I'm waiting with my empty beer glass to get another pint of ale so that I can contribute to the profits of the pub, because that's what public houses are there for the public to come in and for them to be served, I hate somebody in front of me who's ordered two cups of coffee in big, you know, coffee cups, and they, you know, some fancy coffee, which takes absolutely fucking ages to make, you know, with a bit of froth on the top, keeping me from getting my beer, which is what a pub's for. Anyway, so this guy comes in, puts his laptop down, comes back, and he's then sipping his coffee over the next 90 minutes, right? And this is massively irritating. And as I have another pint, I'm thinking, I think I should speak to this guy and remind him of his responsibilities about what pubs are for, okay? And if he doesn't like it, then he can F off because he's annoying me. I also thought maybe I would go up to the bar itself, ask to speak to the manager and warn the manager that somebody's sitting around the corner at the bottom there with one cup of coffee using your pub, your public house, with the warmth that you provide, with the Wi-Fi that you're providing, by the way, to address business on his laptop, and he's tapping away at 10 to the dozen, and he's clearly using your public house as his workplace for the price of a cup of coffee. That's not good. Now, in the end, I didn't do either. I didn't do either because I'm a decent chap, okay? And I thought, well, I'll give this guy the benefit of the doubt. He'll probably go in a minute, or he'll go in another 5 minutes, or he might go and buy a drink. And I made a wry comment to him at one stage. I sort of said, as I was going to the bar to get myself a refill in my pint glass, and by the way, it sounds like I've had a lot of pints this afternoon. Not true at all. It was just the odd refill, the odd fill-up, okay? And I said, coffee there then, to help concentrate the brain while you're working. And he cheerily laughed and said, oh, yes, smiled, actually, and said, yes, it does. And I said, this is not an office, you know. He said, what? I beg your pardon? I said, well, you know, it's not an office. What do you mean? And I said, oh, never mind. And I walked off to the pub and came back thinking that he would pick up with me when I came back, but he didn't. He just you know, he was oblivious to it all and just got on with it. Now, I've got a solution for this because I don't want this to keep happening all the time, OK? I bloody hate it when people come into pubs and don't treat them like pubs or treat them as something else, because the spirit of the English pub, the English public house, is unique. You don't get anywhere else in the world. I've worked around the world and there's nowhere like the English pub. Certainly not in America, because they don't really have pubs. They have bars. And for many, many years, they weren't even allowed to have windows in their bars because it was said to be, you know, a throwback to the Prohibition era and all that kind of stuff. But there's nothing like a country pub in America. You get them in Ireland, of course. Wonderful pubs in Ireland, country pubs, beautiful. Get them in Scotland, get them in Wales. You don't get them anywhere else in the world. You get, like, chateau-type places in France, but they're normally, like, in little town or village high street where you sup wine. Anyway, getting back to my solution for this problem, right? My solution for this problem is that in future, when people come in, they should have to pay a rental fee for the table in that pub. And I mean this sincerely, folks, because what I would do is I would, you know, if I was the landlord there and a bloke comes in with a laptop, buys a cup of coffee, I'd say, you can have your cup of coffee, sir. But you'll be sitting at my table for an hour and you get the benefit of my light, my heating, my Wi-Fi, which you're going to use. So I'm afraid that table for an hour is £12.50 in rent. That's what I would do. That's what I do, folks. It's a revolutionary idea, but I think it's the only way to go forward to stop people using and abusing pubs. The guy was also using the lavatory facilities, of course. He was also had the benefit of, you know, a comfortable environment around him, all of which is normally called an office, but no, people are now using pubs freely as their office. It's not good enough, OK? Now, I've got another complaint about pubs I'm going to tell you about, and that is that I cannot honestly stand when I go to a bar, and sometimes it can happen early. Sometimes, because in my industry we start very early, I can sometimes be up and about at 4:30 in the morning and in a studio by 6 or 7 o'clock. And so sometimes, you know, by midday-ish or something like that, might go for a quiet tincture because that's the end of our working day. Now, what I cannot stand is going into a pub and seeing somebody who clearly is an experienced bar person, either a barman or a bar lady, who says to you, oh, hello, so you're all right. And then there's some younger person standing next to them. And what that younger person does is, that younger person is being trained on the job, right, to serve beer in that pub, right? Now, this is a scandal. Do you know why this is a scandal? Supposing you were on a train, and a train, of course, is a pretty complicated machine, and they have highly trained drivers on the train to get you from London to Lime Street in Liverpool or to Edinburgh or somewhere else. That train driver's got to know what he's doing. Now, if they suddenly said over the tannoy, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining our service today. You'll be delighted to know that we have on-the-job training today, and the person driving this train has never driven this train before, but don't worry, an experienced guard will stand next to him and watch him as he's performing the driving duties on this train, and if he makes a mistake, the driver will correct it. It could be too late. What I'm saying is it not a scandal to have training on the job like that? And isn't it a scandal that somebody who's serving your pint has never served it before? And what happens is, it comes out half full in the glass, it comes out all frothy or unfrothy, it comes out flat or it's not right, and then this person, it's usually a young person, and by the way, we've got a labour shortage in this country, so this is going to happen to you folks, it's going to happen to you all the time. We have a labour shortage in this country, and because of that labour shortage, you'll see in most bars and restaurants in this country, in the United Kingdom, a sign in the window saying, bar staff required. Waitress help required. Chefs and cooks required. And these people are being trained on the job because it's a cheap way of training. This is simply not good enough. What they should do is they should have a training school for barmen, barwomen, cooks, you know, anybody else who works in the licensed trade or the catering trade like they do in America. In America, a barman is a very respectable profession and quite highly paid, because a lot of the portion of remuneration that an American bar person takes home is based on the tipping system, usually 15% of your tab. Your tab, of course, being when you run up a bill with your friends and you say, hey, Frankie, open me up a tab. I'm with my friends here. And open up the tab. And then after a couple of hours, you say, OK, Frankie, give me the check. And you get the check. And then the check comes with the agreed unwritten code of 15% on top of that. And if you've been served really nicely during the time, remember, excuse me, air conditioning in my studio. And remember that in America, when they serve you a gin and tonic, it looks like a gin and tonic with ice, with a twist of lemon, with a straw in it, you know, with a large measure of gin and not too large a measure of tonic, and that's where they serve them. And for that, you will get a bonus, right? So if we did the same system in this country, it'd be much better. However, we don't. We train people on the spot. Now, these young people, first of all, they don't know how to pull a pint of beer. Secondly, they then don't know how to even use the till. They don't know how to use the till. Messing around on the till, calling another member of staff over. Oh, I can't. What does beer go under on the till? Well, it goes under B E E R. See, it's there. Oh, yeah, but it wasn't a Tetley. It was a, you know, a Doom Bar or something. Oh, well, it goes under Doom Bar. I mean, it's absolutely pathetic, right? And you have to train him how to do it. Right. What happens when you come back for your third drink and decided I've had enough beer? I think I'll have a glass of Merlot or something like that. They can't find it. They don't even know what it is. They don't know if it's red or white. They didn't even know on one occasion the Pinot Grigio comes in white form. They thought it was red. I mean, all this is absolutely scandalous to me, OK? And I cannot stand that situation. And I must insist that the pub trade in this country gets its act together, all right? And some people would say I'm being curmudgeonian. I'm not. I don't like people talking to me in pubs, OK? There's one thing I cannot stand. There's one thing I cannot stand. It's when I'm sitting there minding my own business, reading my journals, and somebody comes in and comes up to me and says, what a beautiful day. I don't care. I don't want to know about a beautiful day. OK, I am a bit of a misanthrope, I agree. In certain situations, I can't speak to people. I don't want to speak to people. And I certainly don't want them to speak to me. So I never look people in the eye. I always avert their gaze. I try and keep my head down. There are situations, of course, when people want to talk to me because of what I do. And this is Planet Porky, and I am the Porkmeister. And, of course, I greet them warmly. And if they want to have their picture taken, I'm all for that. But small talk, I can't stand. Why would I want to get engaged in small talk with somebody who wants to talk to me about the cricket score on the screen to my left? I'm not watching the cricket, so I don't care. I don't want to talk to them. I know that sounds miserly, but the world would work much better and more efficiently if we didn't spend all our time in small talk and just got on with the business of making things right. I'm sorry if I sound like I'm having a go at pubs. I'm not. I love pubs, but they could be better.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
OK, folks, now what else can I tell you about Planet Porky? Well, let me tell you this, OK? I have bored enough of you long and hard over the years about my feelings for the Beatles, and I ain't going to say anything more about the Beatles. Don't worry about that. However, I am going to say something about their contemporaries at the time, the Rolling Stones. I read a fantastic piece in a rock magazine this week about the end of the Beatles. I said I wasn't going to say anything more. I'm not. But it coincided with the way the Rolling Stones handled their longevity against the Beatles' eight-year lifetime. A bit of a tragedy. That. Anyway, listen, the reason we're talking about this is because you'll all have seen the pictures of Mick Jagger, probably the most iconic rock star in history. Probably, you know, there have been others, of course, there have over the years. But Jagger, as the frontman of the Rolling Stones, been going 50 years, has to be one of the leaders. Now, we're all very shocked to hear that when he went through the medical for insurance purposes prior to their American tour of their latest world tour, the American leg of their latest world tour, they detected a problem in his heart. And of course, me having heart problems myself, only one third of my heart works, as you all know, I was, of course, greatly concerned. So what I decided to do was keep a close eye on it and try and advise that Mick Jagger should never take to the stage again. Now, we didn't know exactly what the problem was at the time. We found out later, a leaky valve in his heart. Now, as you all know, I'm not exactly a heart surgeon, but I have mixed with great surgeons. Dr. Nicholas Banner is my consultant cardiologist at Harefield Hospital. Very proud to be a patient of Dr. Banner's. A really eminent man, eminent doctor. And I know the leaky valve is not good, OK? I mean, it's good job Mick hasn't got dilated cardiomyopathy, which I've got, because you simply couldn't prance around on stage if you did. That's why when I decided to enter the Great North Run, I had to walk it for 13 miles, couldn't run, can't get enough oxygen around my body. But that's another story. However, with Mick Jagger, Mick is so determined to get back on the road, OK? And he's, by the way, loved by millions around the world for all the iconic songs that he's led the singing on all these years. He suddenly puts out a video, which you'll all have seen, millions of people have seen it, of a very short video of Mick prancing around in a studio, by the look of it. I don't mean a recording studio, I mean a dance studio, fitness studio and all that. And doing a bit of the wiggle, doing a bit of the gyration and all this. Now, look, I want to make 2 points here, right? I don't want to sound like I'm putting a downer on anything, but I still think it's extremely risky for a man of Mick Jagger's age, who is 75, to suddenly get back up on a stage and present a very energetic two-hour show where he is expected, literally expected, to be prancing around, jumping up and down, running up and down platforms, never stops moving for 2 hours. I think somebody told me once he could get through something like 13 miles of walking, if you see what I mean, or moving around the stage in a two-hour set, you know, 90-minute, two-hour set, because he's so energetic. Now, you don't have to be a heart surgeon to work out that if you've got a heart that's just been repaired, and heart surgery, by the way, has a hugely successful rate of survival for the people who go through it. Even heart transplant patients mostly live these days up to 2 years, and many much longer. Some of the people that I've associated with the Harefield have lived for 20 years after having a heart transplant. But nevertheless, I believe it to be dodgy for that to happen. And I wish people would advise Mick, and I wish Mick would listen again about doing it, because last thing we want to see is Mick Jagger in distress on a stage that he's graced so magnificently for 50 years. Now, there is another reason to this, and again, I don't wish to sound unkind, but Mick Jagger is 75, I've already mentioned, right? That is old. That is getting old. 75 years of age is an age now where I do not believe it's actually very, what's the word I'm looking for? I just don't think it looks very good for a 75-year-old man to be prancing around on a stage. Now, Mick, Keith Richard, who also plays in the Stones and is about the same age, but largely has a sedate position in Stones concerts these days. He either sits up on a bit of scaffolding high up with his guitar in his hand, or he moves around the stage, but nothing like the rate that Mick Jagger does. And of course, you know, Jagger Richards are a legendary duo, written some of the greatest songs of the second half of the 20th century. They know what they're doing. They understand each other. But I think Keith Richards looks better these days performing than Mick Jagger does. I think Mick Jagger, this is a terrible thing to say, I think he looks silly. I think he looks silly at his age. He is stick thin because he keeps himself so terribly fit. He is also a guy now whose age is showing in his face. And I am sorry to have a guy. I'm saying this because I want Mick Jagger to really move into a period of his life when dignity, in my view, is required. And of course, I don't want any harm to come to him. Right, OK, folks. Now, what can I tell you? I can tell you this, right? Over a period of about 8 days recently, and you're listening to Planet Porky, by the way, and I'm delighted to be communicating with you because it's great to have you all tuned in. Thank you for all the responses I get to the Planet Porky podcast, by the way. It's lovely of you to be as interested as you are. Now, over a period of 8 days recently, seven people died on the top of Mount Everest, OK? And when I say on the top, I literally mean on the top. Now, in 1953, that New Zealand guy conquered Everest for the first time on the very day that our present monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, was crowned, OK? The coronation took place on the same day. Now, that guy's name, I've forgotten, but it doesn't matter because he's a New Zealander. But he's a great man because he's part of the, you know, British Empire in those days. And Tesha Pershing, or whatever his name was, who was his scout, not his scout, his Sherpa, that's right, his Sherpa, guy who carries, like, the bags, if you see what I mean, when you're climbing Everest, if you see what I mean. And he gets up there, and Sir Edmund Hillary, I've just remembered his name, Sir Edmund Hillary, Hillary as in Hillary Clinton, and although they're not related, because her first name's Hillary and his second name is Hillary, Sir Edmund Hillary, you understand that, obviously. Anyway, what I'm saying is, in those days, he was the only one up there. I mean, literally the only one. He got up there first. Got up there first, and everybody's been trying to conquer it ever since. But it's now become farcical and ludicrous. For instance, it is estimated there could be between 200 and 300 bodies littered around the higher echelons of Mount Everest, the highest mountain in the world. 31,000 feet, I think, off the ground. That's why people want to climb it. It's the highest point off Earth, and it's a fantastic achievement. But these days, it has become like a conveyor belt. You will all have seen probably recent pictures of people queuing up to get to the top of Mount Everest, right? And they are literally queuing up as you would queue up for a bus. It's like a bus queue coming down from the very peak of Mount Everest for about 2 or 3 miles. Now, what's happening is, folks, you won't believe this, people are freezing to death whilst they're waiting to get to the summit. So when you're waiting at that height, so you must be up to about 30,000 feet or something like that, it's minus 25 degrees and people simply perish. They get exposure. They get, you know, that's what's that thing that happens when you freeze to death? You know, I don't know what it is, but well, obviously you're frozen to death. But what I'm saying is that these people then, some of them fall off the mountain. And they are irrecoverable because there are no facilities to bring stiff, dead bodies, because you get very stiff in minus 25, obviously, and the bodies are preserved forever, and they could be recovered at any time if there was such a thing as an Everest dead body recovery scheme, which there isn't, because why would you waste your time bringing a body down from 31,000 feet to back to base camp just to thaw it out and give it to the relatives? The relatives themselves have got to sort that out. But the problem is that older people and old women amongst those who died are simply dying of exposure if they don't fall off. And sometimes they fall off because when you get to that height as well, you may be using oxygen, you probably are, but at some stage you might want to take your oxygen mask off to take a picture of yourself, because obviously it's not every day you get to the top of Everest. Take the picture off. What happens then? You get giddy, you get vertigo, you get discombobulated, you stagger around, boom, off the over the mountain. And sometimes, in a rather grisly scenario to paint to you, sometimes these bodies are actually viewed by others going up and down. I mean, look, it's a terrible situation, and I think we've got to do something about it sooner rather than later. I mean, do you know that it can cost you 54,000 quid to get up to the top of Everest? I'm not joking. What you do is these days, you don't just go and hire your own Sherpas at base camp, say, right, you six are going to carry all my gear up with me. What you do is you go to these companies, which proliferate, that's to get it right, on two sides of Mount Everest. One side is in Kathmandu, I think, and the other one is in Tibet. And the climbers go up from either side. But there are specialist companies there whose business is to provide escorts and facilities to get you up to the top of Everest. 54,000 quid you can pay to do that. I say now it needs regulating. I think it's being abused, the position. I think people with more money than sense are causing an absolutely catastrophic human dilemma in this world that we simply do not need. I say, get ye down from Everest. In 1953, that New Zealand guy conquered Everest for the first time on the very day that our present monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, was crowned, OK? The coronation took place on the same day. Now, that guy's name I've forgotten, but it doesn't matter because he's a New Zealander. But he's a great man because he's part of the, you know, British Empire in those days. And Tesha Pershing, or whatever his name was, who was his scout, not his scout, his Sherpa, that's right, his Sherpa, guy who carries, like, the bags, if you see what I mean, when you're climbing Everest, if you see what I mean. When you're waiting at that height, so you must be up to about 30,000 feet or something like that, it's minus 25 degrees and people simply perish. They get exposure, they get, you know, that's what's that thing that happens when you freeze to death? You know, I don't know what it is, but, well, obviously you're frozen to death. But what I'm saying is that these people then, some of them fall off the mountain and they are irrecoverable. Because there are no facilities to bring stiff, dead bodies, because you get very stiff in minus 25, obviously, and the bodies are preserved forever, and they could be recovered at any time if there was such a thing as an Everest dead body recovery scheme, which there isn't. It sounds like I've had a lot of pints this afternoon. Not true at all. It was just the odd refill, the odd fill-up, OK.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Save big at Menards and prepare for the summer heat with a new air conditioner from Denali Air. Quickly and efficiently cool your spaces with auto and eco modes to maximize performance and save on energy costs. Cool your space from anywhere in the room with three cooling speeds and a remote control. Save big money on Denali Air air conditioners. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week.
Save big.